It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Earlier this month, President Biden signed an executive order to make it easier for tribal nations to access federal funding. According to a White House statement, the executive order is an attempt to remedy historical attacks on tribal sovereignty and support tribal nations' right to self-governance.
That's why today I'm signing an executive order to reform the federal funding system for tribes, cutting out red tape so you can deliver for your community faster and better.
Levi Rickard is the founder, publisher, and editor of Native News Online. He was in the nation's capital earlier this month for the two-day Tribal Nations Summit, where the new executive order was released. Levi, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, happy to be back, Tyler.
Can you talk about why accessing federal funds has been difficult for many tribes across the country?
Well, often when tribes have tried to access federal funds, it's been real cumbersome, very difficult. Sometimes they don't know where to go. And the executive order, kind of under the heading of self-determination for tribes, was really set forth a pathway to make it easier for tribes to access funds. I will tell you this, that this administration has been one of the most favorable administrations towards tribal nations, Indian country, as we call it, in my lifetime. And quite frankly, it's difficult sometimes because in the past, because tribes quite didn't know where to go. And this is going to provide like a clearinghouse. And it's really, as I said, setting the pathway. It's signed 2 weeks ago on Wednesday. So it's way too early to say how it's working because I'm not sure it's working.
It's brand new. And a report that came out, I think linked to the tribal summit, suggested that, you know, okay, with the current system of bureaucracy, a tribe with more resources might be able to navigate it, but smaller tribes or ones with the less money to work with, maybe without as big a legal department, it potentially shut them out of receiving money that they might otherwise have had access to. Is that something you've seen?
That's very true. And it was really particularly true during the COVID-19 pandemic, when it wasn't just for Indians, Indian country per se, but others. You know, there was a lot of money that was given out by the federal government to get through the pandemic. Tribes, in some cases, had to turn the money back in. They just didn't have the capabilities. And even at, you mentioned legal, but even at grant writing levels, they don't always have that. And I think as we move forward, I think it's this administration is looking real hard at how to work with tribes so that they can have the technical assistance that's needed. And the president called it red tape. I tend to call it white tape. It's kind of as a joke, but that was probably the biggest misgiving of his speech. When he said that, I wanted to yell out, "Hey, what's white tape?" It seems to always be that adhesive that stops us from moving forward, the old notorious red tape.
I want to talk a little more about, you mentioned that tribal access to capital clearinghouse. As you said, it's brand new. We don't know what it's doing so far, but what is the concept here? Tell us a little bit more about what it's supposed to do and how you hope it could work.
Well, within government itself, tribes, my understanding, and I may be off two or three, but there's like 17 agencies, federal departments, agencies that Native Americans tribes really work with. And sometimes there would be programs being administered or offered by various programs, very similar, and it's very, very confusing to tribes. And I think the clearinghouse, we understand, is really going to simplify it so that tribes, when they can get into a database, can really figure out where they need to go for what funds and how they can be spent. Are they loans? Are they grants? Those types of things. And you know, anyone who's ever applied for a federal grant knows it's very, very difficult process, very cumbersome.
Talking to Levi Rickard, founder, publisher, and editor of Native News Online, talking about a new executive order that affects how tribal governments around the country relate with the federal government, trying to make it easier to access money that they're eligible for in the first place. Levi, it may sound like a bureaucratic change to some people, but as you wrote and some others have written, this is also connected to the idea of tribal sovereignty, that that tribal governments will have, I think, fewer strings attached to how they manage their own affairs. Can you talk about that side of things?
Yes, and I will say this, across the country, there are varying levels of sophistication among the tribes, and some tribes have and there's different periods of time that the government dealt with us in different ways, and they basically terminated a lot of tribes in the 1950s, and some of the tribes have just, in a sense, gotten their federal recognition back. And with that, they're really like infant tribes, even toddler tribes. They're not sophisticated as like the Cherokee Nation that has been in existence for what, almost 200 years, and has had a relationship with the federal government. But those new tribes that come on board, will say, I think just in the last 5 years, there's been about five or six across the country. And they really have a difficult time learning the ropes, as they say. And as the president called it red tape, I call it white tape. But in terms of sovereignty and self-determination, it really is, how can I say, it's faster to get to being a sovereign if you know what you're doing and you can afford to do what you want to do as a sovereign nation. And that, I love that term, self-determination. So often as we Native Americans have lived under a paternalistic philosophy from the federal government, you will do it our way. Well, this new era will bring in the idea that tribes can hire the right people and make the right decisions through their tribal sovereign governments.
I want to quote from the piece you wrote about this, Levi. President Biden, quoting now, President Biden, Secretary Holland realized there's still much work to be done to correct the decades and arguably centuries of neglect by the federal government to fulfill their treaty trust obligations to Indian country. What do you mean by that neglect? Tell us about some of the things that fit into that.
Well, you know, and I'll use broadband as a very prime example. We are so far behind when it comes to broadband on many Indian reservations throughout the United States. I mean, I've heard and I've written about where parents have to literally drive to the McDonald's, or they drive 30 miles so their children can do homework, and because there's lack of broadband. And I guess our treaties basically said the trust responsibility of the government should be able to provide us with some of the basic needs of life. And I think most of us would argue internet these days is a basic need of life, especially for our kids who have to compete with those kids in affluent suburbs, but who have, you know, various devices at home, laptops, tablets, etc., and they have the internet. But our kids literally have to get in their parents' pickup truck, and they have to, you know, like I say, go to the McDonald's, or they go to a tribal police department, sit outside there. And there's one case, I think it was in Arizona, where so many parents were taking them outside a police station that it basically jammed the station ability to have their own internet and said, hey, we can't let you guys do this anymore. You're impeding our public safety. So there's a lot of things that go into it. And from a real practical sense, the reality checks of life, we are far behind in many areas. And so hopefully this executive order will help us get to where we need to be in terms of those trust responsibilities the federal government have.
And briefly, this also includes an assessment, I understand, of chronic funding shortfalls for tribes to figure out where gaps are, where additional funding is needed. What, in just our last less than a minute now, what do you hope that would focus on?
Well, I'll go right back to where I was talking about broadband. I would love to see that get fixed. I was on the phone yesterday, did an interview with somebody who works in the area of agriculture. She said our shortfall in Indian country is $49 billion. That's with a B, $49 billion for the native farmers to be able to exercise their abilities to farm and get back to some food sovereignty and kind of go back so grow products so we can eat healthy. And $49 billion is a lot of money, and that's a shortfall that's not going to be made up in 1 year or maybe even 10 years.
Levi, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Hey, my pleasure.
That's Levi Rickert, founder, publisher, and editor of Native News Online. He talked to us today about President Biden's executive order to increase tribal access to federal funding. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. In the ever-changing landscape of the book industry, one genre is standing out as the fastest growing in fiction, particularly among young adult readers. Romance novels were the highest-selling genre of fiction in 2022, with research company Circana reporting 19 million units sold just through August of last year. That followed a strong 2021, and the genre is seeing a two-year high in overall growth. Analysts say stores are dedicating more shelf space to romance, and the social media app TikTok may be helping the genre reach new, younger audiences. We're visiting the world of romance novels to learn why readers are having a love affair with the books. Jessica Van Sloten is the Dean of Arts and Sciences at Bay College in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. Her research focuses on teaching and learning, and she also is a scholar of popular romance fiction. She formerly taught at UW-Green Bay, where she gave a TEDx talk entitled Romance Novels Are Feminist. Jessica, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me, Rob. It's great to be here.
How do we define the romance genre? You know, a lot of books will have a love angle to them. What is it that makes something a romance novel?
Yes, that's a great question to start us off with, because often there's a lot of confusion about how to qualify something as a romance. So there's basically two essential elements that mark something as romance. It needs to have a central love story, so that needs to be the main focus. And it needs to have what the romance writers of America call an emotionally satisfying and optimistic ending.
Now, romance novels are selling great, but they sometimes don't get a lot of respect, it seems like, for a couple reasons. I think some people just look down on them as, maybe formulaic or cliche on one hand. And then something I know you've talked about, including in that TEDx talk I mentioned, is that from a feminist angle, people say, well, is this really a great message? You, I think, are defending romance novels these days from both of those concerns. Make your case.
Yeah, so I think they have been historically maligned since the beginning. It was fiction that was primarily associated with women, and there was a lot of skepticism around that and around things that women like. And as the genre has kind of expanded, where I see the promise is that it's giving messages of hope and possibility to all kinds of people to be loved for who they are. We see a big rise in representation of LGBTQ folks in romance novels, in people of color in romance novels. And so that's where I see the potential and the celebration of joy rather than only oppression, right? So those are some of the ways that I personally embrace the genre, and I know some of my fellow readers do as well.
In addition to having just a more diverse array of characters and maybe authors, are there other ways in which you've seen romance novels change over the years?
Yeah, I think there's been a transformation, particularly of the biggest genre convention that people like to think about, the ending, right? That historically romance novels ended in marriage. If you think of Jane Austen's classic novels as romance, they always end with, the couple getting married, what we call the happily ever after. And over time, that really transformed into what we call a happily for now, right? There's more of a temporariness sometimes to those endings, and what that happy ending looks like is going to be different. And so I think that's something that's interesting. We also see a change in the voice, right? It was really popular for a long time to have alternate voices. So if you had a traditional heterosexual romance, you would have one chapter from the male perspective, the next from the female, back and forth. And in the last couple of years, we've seen a rise in single point of view romance novels.
Now, we've seen pretty good sales numbers, as I was saying at the beginning, and some thought at any way that that younger people, young adults, are driving some of those increases. What do you see as the appeal of the modern romance novel to younger readers?
Yeah, I think it's fascinating to think about how this rise parallels both the rise of first Bookstagram, which is sort of people my generation, Gen X, gravitated towards that social media, and younger generations transforming that into BookTok, right? So on TikTok, as well as the pandemic, right? And just the influence that had on people's habits of consumption of media and the kinds of stories that they were looking for. And what romance provides with us is hope and possibility, a place where characters are loved for who they truly are, and vulnerability, as well as some interesting rise in a kind of dark romance subgenre. So I think, getting at the uncertain times that we've lived in, and romance gives us a nice container that we know things are going to end well in the end of the book, even if it's turbulent throughout. So I think those couple of threads are important. And the third one I would mention is the rise in sort of a parasocial relationship, the ways that consumers of media can be connected to the creators of media through social media, right? They can follow their favorite authors on TikTok and Instagram and feel like they're having a relationship with them, right? And so there's a closeness that's very exciting and appealing for readers.
Talking to Jessica Van Sloten with Bay College in the UP in Michigan, looking at romance novels, a big boost in popularity lately, and they've changed over the years too. Now, that talk I mentioned you did at UW Green Bay a couple few years ago, looking at seeing romance novels as feminist and not just as some people have criticized, reinforcing gender norms. Can you give us a Cliff's Notes version of what were you, the case you were making there?
Sure. I think the case I made in that TED talk was that we really see these stories that are places of positivity and a way for people to work out their relationships to power. So a scholar I really admire, Catherine Roach, thinks that romance novels give folks who don't have as much power, traditionally women or maybe LGBTQ folks, ways of leveling the playing field through romantic relationships, right? So, if you think about your typical romance storyline, there's conflict, but in the end, there's happiness and usually some kind of egalitarianism. And so that's one thread that I think makes them a potentially feminist genre.
I'm a science fiction reader. That's kind of my genre. And there's some works where I'll, defend the writing and the innovation and things like that, and they're awesome. And there's some that are, kind of cliche and formulaic, but I still kind of like them anyway because it's my kind of thing. Do you see that kind of variation as well within the romance novel genre?
Yes, definitely, right? And as I was as thinking about coming on the air today, I'm thinking there's whole subgenres that I just don't read, right? For one reason or another, they're just not my something that I'm drawn to. And that as someone who has a literary background too, I'm really interested in the quality of the writing and the craft of the plot, right? And there is a lot of variation. And I think the most important thing is that people are finding stories that resonate with them. And for each reader, that's going to be a little bit different. And romance is such a big tent that there's something for everyone. And the rise of self-publishing has allowed more people to write stories and get them in front of readers. And I think that's a powerful other component of this rise in popularity.
Now, if somebody's listening and thinking, okay, yeah, I'm a reader. Maybe you've got me almost persuaded with this romance novel thing to check it out. Where do, you can name names if you want here, Jessica. Where would you steer them to start? Like, what would be a good entry point or author or subgenre or whatever that new romance novel reader could open the door with?
Yeah, I'd like to tell you about a book I'm reading right now. I
Okay.
haven't finished it, but I know it's going to have a happy ending because that's the promise of the genre. But it's by an author named Adriana Herrera, and it's called A Caribbean Heiress in Paris. And it's a historical romance. So if there's any fans out there of Bridgerton, for example, this might be for you. It's set in 1899 Paris World's Exposition. And she does a lot of really clever things in updating a historical romance in that she has characters of color, characters, from the Caribbean islands who have envisioned a way to produce liquor not relying on slave labor, right? And so she's really making some interesting statements and really transforming and modernizing the genre and doing it in a historical time setting, which I think is pretty cool.
Now, a personal example for me, I grew up thinking, Jane Austen, you mentioned earlier, I'm a guy and that's mostly written for women. So I never touched it. I didn't consciously avoid it. And then I started reading Jane Austen. I'm like, this is really good. And I read more and more. Can you make the case to the guys like me out there who might think romance novels, they're just not for me to begin with?
Yeah, I think one interesting way to think about it is that Jane Austen was writing what we might call domestic fiction, right? And male authors have written that over time, right? Maybe the narratives have had a different arc, or they've prioritized things other than the love relationship. But even if someone is, say, a Jonathan Franzen fan, right? He writes these complex families and relationships, right? So I would say that someone could pick up a romance novel and find some interest and satisfaction. And actually, there's a great author, Lissa K. Adams, writes these bromance book club series, and it's about a group of men who read romance novels in order to have better relationships. So, and they're pro athletes who are in this club that read together. So, there's a lot of interesting entry points for readers of all genders.
Jessica, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That was Jessica Van Sloten, Dean of Arts and Sciences and a scholar of popular romance fiction at Bay College in Michigan's Upper Peninsula. We listened back to our talk with her about the rising popularity of romance novels and how the genre has changed over time. If you are a fan of the genre, if you have favorites, let us know about it. Email ideas@wpr.org. I'm Rob Barrett. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. The 21 countries of Latin America, including South America, Central America, Mexico, parts of the Caribbean, are home to some of the richest and most flavorless culinary traditions in the world. And we have an expert on those traditions with us today for Food Friday, with the author of a new cookbook with more than 300 home-style recipes from all over that region. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your favorite Latin American or Latin American-inspired recipes, ingredients, dishes? Do you have a family recipe that fits the bill that you'd like to tell us about? Tell us about the best Latin American food you've ever eaten. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Sandra Gutierrez is a journalist, food historian, a professional cooking instructor, and author of 5 cookbooks. Her latest is called Latinissimo, Home Recipes from the 21 Countries of Latin America. Sandra, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hello, Rob. Thank you for having me.
Now, I'll admit, I grew up in a small town in the Midwest. Latin American food that I encountered was Taco Bell and not much more. We're getting so much more availability to food, not just from Mexico now, but all over the region. Can you talk about, this region and the food it's bringing us, this great food it's bringing us in the United States?
Yes, your experience, you're not alone in it. Most people have tried Mexican food and that's it. And that is why in my book, I explain that Mexican food is the front door to Latin American cuisines. But once you cross over the threshold of that house, you will find 20 other kitchens inside. And each one is as exciting and as valuable and as vibrant as the next. It's an area that is very varied. A lot of different cultures have melded depending on the territory that they found themselves in. And so each country has a very distinct flavor.
Can you talk a little more about that melding of different cultures? Because, I would have guessed a few different cultures, but actually there are people from all over the world bringing their traditions into Latin America.
Yes, and it's fascinating. The first people, of course, being the indigenous groups, the indigenous nations in Latin America, several of which, the most renowned, the Inca, the Aztec, the Mayas, but many, many more. And then, of course, the conquerors or the Spaniards and Portuguese, namely the Iberians that came and conquered Latin America and then brought the enslaved people from the Africas to replace the population that they had decimated. And after that, at the same time that Ellis Island is getting this massive migration from all over the world, they are also going to Latin American countries and different groups of people land in different countries, in different territories, in different numbers. So, for example, you have a lot of Italians in New York, for instance, but they also went down to Argentina. They fell in love with the Argentinian land where they could produce wine and it reminded them of home. And a lot of Germans went to Chile, for instance, which is the country right next to Argentina, producing two very different cuisines, and so on and so forth. You have a lot of Chinese, Hakka, and Japanese influence in Peru, and you have a lot of American influence, North American influence in Panama, and so on. They're all different groups of people, and of course, many more groups that meet in different countries, meaning the Jews, the Lebanese, they all meet with different cultures like Italians in different countries, but their numbers and the dissimilar combinations is what creates these flavors that are so unique.
Sandra, you've been through this amazing journey. What is it that you were looking for to find the recipes that were going to make the cut in this book to represent this huge region?
They had to be recipes that home cooks in Latin America that are contemporary to our cooks here are making today. So I didn't want any of the esoteric, rare kind of recipes that people, what I call the National Geographic effect, you know, that people usually think of Latin American food as being very exotic and very different and very frightening. No, they had to be modern recipes that have survived over time. So some of them can actually have indigenous roots, but that they're still being made today. They have to be easy with ingredients that are very easy to find no matter where you find yourself. So you would not have any trouble finding your ingredients in your regular supermarket, with a few exceptions, and you can order those online, very, very few exceptions. And then they have to be practical with techniques that the everyday cook knows how to do already. Because what I was trying to do was really make a collection of recipes for the modern cook of today.
It's Food Friday. Sandra Gutierrez is with us. Her new book is called Latinissimo, Home Recipes from the 21 Countries of Latin America. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite restaurant food that you've had from Mexican cuisine or South America, Central America, the Caribbean? Is there something that you've encountered and made yourself maybe in your travels? Or are we talking about the food you grew up with? Love to hear about that at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Sandra, you shared a couple recipes with us. We've got them online at wpr.org/foodfriday. Let's check this one out. A pasta con palta. Now, I looked at this and said, wait, this is pasta and pesto? Isn't that Italian? Hold on. It's pasta with avocado pesto, which I don't think I've ever had. Tell us about it.
It's a delicious, creamy rendition of pesto, and it is from Chile, the country Chile. And I find it fascinating that even though we all speak Spanish in Latin America, the words are not always the same. So palta means avocado, which of course most people recognize as aguacate. But aguacate is the Nahuatl or Aztec word for it. And once you cross over to South America, it becomes palta. The recipe is so, so simple. It's quicker to make than regular pesto. And it really is a mixture of avocado and walnuts, some salt, some garlic, some olive oil. And while the pasta is cooking, you blend this together in the blender. As soon as the pasta comes out of the pot, you combine it. And the avocado sauce becomes warm and creamy. It's truly delectable. Very sophisticated and yet super easy and super inexpensive to make.
Sounds fantastic. Again, you can find that at WPR.org/Food Friday. Now, you start off the book with a bunch of sauces that we can make, represent that we're going to use in a lot of these recipes. On the Ideas Network Facebook page, Pete mentioned one of them. He's a fan of chimichurri sauce, which I think is from Argentina mostly. You've got a couple recipes. What goes into a good chimichurri sauce?
Yes, the chimichurri, known widely through South America, is an Argentinian sauce, and it's based on pesto. What goes into a really good chimichurri are fresh herbs, in particular parsley, fresh Italian parsley. You have some red pepper flakes, you have quality red wine vinegar and olive oil, and then that's where the variations begin. Because if you go to Central America, they have replaced the parsley with cilantro. And many Argentinians will add tomato to their chimichurri, and some will add carrots and celery to their chimichurri. So it's basically an herb sauce used as an accoutrement or a side or a topping to steaks and to other protein. It really is delicious. The two recipes that I picked are very different, and I do offer variations in the book so people can taste what similar foods in different countries are like.
Now, I said chimichurri is Argentinian, and you agreed. Are there foods where, like, there are arguments from one country to the next or one region to the next? Like, no, we invented that. You borrowed it.
Oh, that's a great question. Yes, there are many of those, of course. I would say even within the same country, and that's why I stay away from the word authentic, because if a Guatemalan grandmother is making arroz con pollo, which is chicken and rice, in their home and adding capers and olives, but her neighbor next door to her is actually adding peas and carrots, who is to say which one is authentic and which one isn't, when they're both amazing and they're both the same variety of ingredients going into a pot with a few differences? That happens throughout Latin America, but we have become used to that, because the variations of recipes that are repeated throughout Latin America makes each unique. For example, I'll tell you the simple sauce that came from the Spaniards, who themselves got it from the Persians: sofrito. And that is the mirepoix, which is the French flavor base of Latin American cuisine. Sofrito started by being just a mixture of onions and olive oil that were cooked, and that would be the base to a recipe. But once you cross over to the Americas, you start getting different countries adding different ingredients. So for example, in Cuba, you'll have them add bell peppers and tomato and achiote, which is annatto. Annatto, of course, is what makes cheddar cheese orange. So you've all had annatto, even though it sounds like a foreign
ingredient. Oh, here in Wisconsin, we've eaten a lot of it, yes.
You've had cheddar cheese in Wisconsin, I know that. So you're familiar with that. But the Cubans will add that to their sofrito, making it a completely different color. And then in Central America, you have the additions of tomatoes on top of that, and so on and so forth. In Puerto Rico, you will not have any tomatoes. You will actually have an herb called culantro, which is a sawtooth cilantro, it's called. It's a long leaf cilantro, very different from what we typically know as cilantro in the rest of the Americas. So every country added their own ingredient, making one recipe into many. And that is why I tell you, we're used to having these competitions of we made it first. It really doesn't matter. It's who makes it last that matters, I think.
It's Food Friday. We're talking to food writer Sandra Gutierrez about her new cookbook, Latinissimo, Home Recipes from the 21 Countries of Latin America. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you've traveled to Mexico, Central America, South America, or the Caribbean, do you have some favorite foods you encountered along the way? If your family has origins in Latin America, what are some of your family's favorite dishes? The food you grew up with, have you modified it for life here in Wisconsin along the way? Do you have favorite dishes or questions for our guest? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up our Food Friday conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our Food Friday conversation with Sandra Gutierrez, food writer and author of the new cookbook, Latinissimo, Home Recipes from the 21 Countries of Latin America. We're talking about dishes from all over the Caribbean, South and Central America, up to Mexico. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about food that you like, that you love, that you want to know more about, that you want to know how to make that one particular thing you had at a restaurant or while traveling? Or did you grow up with food from one of these traditions we're talking about? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or I don't know, maybe you're calling for some takeout based on this conversation. Join in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Now, Sandra, we've got another recipe you shared with us up at WPR.org/Food Friday. Now, growing up, in Michigan, plantains, I wouldn't have known. Is that a banana? They weren't at stores. Now they're all over the place, easy to find even at non-specialty grocery stores. I love them. I can't get enough of them. You've got plátanos con tocino, or plantain and bacon hash. Now, this is plantains, bacon, and eggs, a winner in my book. Tell us about the recipe.
Absolutely. I wanted to include ingredients that are not traditionally Latin American and, however, have made one of the biggest impacts in our food. And one of those is plantains. They actually come from Africa. Mm-hmm. And when they're green, they're used as a vegetable. They are starchy and they can be used as a potato. You can fry it into fries and mash it into mashes, you know, like mashed potatoes. But when they're sweet and they're yellow and turning a little brown, they become so delicious to cook. And bacon, of course, is salty, and bacon is bacon. Bacon has that umami flavor we all love. And in combination, they make this very delicious, easy breakfast dish from Honduras. And that was part of what I wanted to do in this book. It was to demystify Latin American food. It's not all spicy. It's not all cheese laden. It's not all covered in sauces. And you will find a lot of similarities between the food of Latin America and foods that you're, you know, used to eating here. So, you know, like your potato hash with bacon, or your casseroles that you have with potatoes or sweet potatoes and chives. This is a very simple rendition of a hash. And it's just plantains that are cooked in rendered bacon fat. And then you add the crispy bacon to it, and you top it with a fried egg, and it's just, an amazing breakfast.
Now let's talk about using those plantains. Now, when we want them in that less ripe, that's easy to tell. When I get plantains, I let it look like they're rotting on the outside, like the peel is getting black, and then they're ready for this kind of recipe, right? That means the inside is ripe.
That's right. It almost looks like it's rotting, and that's the amazing thing about it. But at that point, it's sweet. But the fun thing about it is that if you buy them when they're still green, you can actually shred them, you can cut them into big pieces and double fry them. So you fry them once and then you mash it down into a chip, and then you fry it a second time. Those are called tostones. And I offer a lot of recipes with all the different kinds of, or different styles of ripeness of the plantains, the stages. And like that I do with many, many ingredients in the book. This is an ingredient-based cookbook, mm-hmm. because I find that many of the cuisines have the same ingredients that thread them together, even though they produce completely different results. And that was important for me. It is essential that people get to know the food of your neighbors. I don't know why in the United States we went so far into first exploring the food of Asia and the Middle East and all the cookbooks, you know, from Europe. And we have truly left Latin America on the side, when it is actually a fascinating melting pot of global flavors.
You mentioned you organized the cookbook. I was expecting country by country. No, it's some base ingredients. One of them is corn. I like corn. Can you talk about some of the varieties of ways that corn is used across these 21 countries?
Yes, I call corn the backbone of the Americas. It's the one ingredient we all have in common, North America into Central America into South America. And corn in Latin America has very different ways of being used. You can use it raw, like we use it here, and eat it in salads like the esquite salad in Mexico. Or you can nixtamalize it, which means that you get your flint corn or heirloom corn and make it go through a chemical reaction where you put it in water that has been treated with calcium hydroxide, which makes the heirloom corn lose its outer kernel. And then that is what you mill and you make masa from, and that is what you make tortillas and tamales from. But once you go into South America, the corn goes into a different chemical reaction, and a different way of processing it, and you get this flour, which is also instant, like your masa harina, but it is pre-cooked flour. Masa harina has not been pre-cooked. It's called masa arepa or arepa flour, and you make these corn cakes that are truly delectable. They are mostly found in Venezuela and in Colombia, and they can be different thicknesses, but it's not pliable. They're not pliable like tortillas where you can fold around the food. These actually serve as bases or as bread or as a sandwich that you can actually cut through in the middle. And the outside of it is like toasty and wonderfully crispy and delicious, but the inside remains soft like polenta, and that is the flavor that you get, and that's different from tortillas. And then of course you cook them, you put them in stews. It depends where you are, the different uses of corn, but it is the ingredient that is central to all of the cuisines of the Americas.
It's Food Friday, talking to Sandra Gutierrez about her new cookbook, Latinissimo, Home Recipes from the 21 Countries of Latin America. All right, Sandra, a great food that's in abundance in Wisconsin right now is squash, our winter squash. There's still some summer squash lurking out there as well. That is one of your ingredients. Can you share some inspiration? Let's go with winter squash. You've got some butternut and things like that. What's a good inspiration from your travels and journeys for us to do here in Wisconsin with our winter squash?
There's a wonderful locro, or a special soup from Ecuador, that's made with potato and squash, and then they add fresh cheese to it. It is subtle, it is warm, and of course, you know, it embraces you on a cold night, but it also has this depth of flavor that there's no spice in it, there's no heat in it in terms of chiles, but it has a little bit of cumin, and it offers you this delicious new twist on what would be a normal butternut squash soup. It's really, really good. We also cook squashes in sweet recipes, so you will find them transformed into jams and jellies. You will find them used in the summer squash. You will find use in a dish from Mexico called calabacitas, which is simply stir-fried a zucchini and yellow squash with pimentos and with tomatoes and onions, and it's really delicious. You make it in about 20 minutes and you serve it with your dinner, or you can top pasta with it or do a lot of other things. The point of each one of these ingredients is that once it falls into the hands of the different groups of people who are already in the countries but also descend into the countries from different parts of the world, they get changed and transformed into dishes that are not as different as those that you've tasted before. So everybody's used now to having a butternut squash soup or a bisque in the fall and winter. You will find different renditions of that in Latin America. And that's what I wanted my readers to take and the cooks to find, recipes that don't ask them to take a very big leap of faith where they're going to go, oh my goodness, that sounds so weird. But on the contrary, there are things that they can say, well, I love minestrone soup, so that means I will love the minestra from Argentina, which is a similar soup. Or I love pasta sauce, and I would love to try the Peruvian pasta sauce that's made, again, with annatto, which you use to color cheddar cheese, and different ingredients, and has actually no tomatoes. So all these different ideas that I want people to feel comfortable trying, because it only takes a little bit of imagination to say, I know what it resembles, and you don't have to feel like I'm sending you through this voyage of very exotic, different foods.
Now, Sandra, as I mentioned, there's like 300 recipes in this book. That sounds like a lot, but I understand you narrowed this down from the thousands of recipes. Do you have a sequel concept in the works? Because you got a lot more material lying around.
I have boxes and boxes of recipes lying around. And it was really hard to make the cut. I went from 9,000 to 3,000 to 2,000. And then my editor started saying, you know, cutting and cutting. Because you can't make a book that big. It would take, you know, a train to carry each book. It already is a big book as it is. But I tried to find the recipes that represent, like I told you at the beginning, food that home cooks are making today in their homes. So with modern equipment like blenders and food processors and things that really will, I think resonate to the American cook today. So there are recipes with very easy ingredients to find, not expensive recipes to make, and things that are similar to other foods that people have had before, which will give you a nice picture of the kinds of food that Latin Americans eat it's not what most people think. It's not, the iguana from the jungle in Guatemala that you have to macerate in chiles for 7 days before you cook it, or weird recipes like that. We actually eat very similar food. So nice chicken cooked in coconut that will remind you of a Thai curry, but it's actually from Panama, or
Fantastic.
a delicious soup that re will remind you of a chowder because it's made with coconut milk, but it's actually from Belize. And
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to our Food Friday guest, Sandra Gutierrez. Her new book is called Latinissimo, Home Recipes from the 21 Countries of Latin America. You can find a couple recipes from the book over at WPR.org/Food Friday. Are you prepared for a weekend of cookies, or maybe you've been eating them for weeks now? Either way, what kind of cookies are you making and or eating? Wisconsin has a number one cookie recipe on its mind this time of year, at least according to online searches. As reported in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, Google released a list of the top Christmas cookie searches by state. Number one here in Wisconsin, it's the peanut butter blossom. That's the peanut butter cookie with a Hershey's Kiss on top. Been eating these all my life. My grandma made those and like 20 other kinds of cookies, but I guess I never knew they were called peanut butter blossoms. I just called them the peanut butter cookies with a Hershey's Kiss on top. Looking to our neighbors, Minnesota is on the same page, peanut butter blossoms. Illinois has red velvet cookies as their top search. Michigan goes for sugar cookies. I'm from Michigan, that checks out. Iowa picks peppermint Christmas cookies. Yuck! As always, C is for cookie, that good enough for me. C is also for Central Time on the Ideas Network. Thank you.